Afternoon in the matter of Angel Alberto Pareja versus Princeton International Properties et al. Can we please have appearances of counsel?
Your Honor, William Bloom on behalf of Princeton International Properties, the appellant.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Mark Sirocco from Sirocco Law on behalf of the New Jersey Defense Association as amicus curiae.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. David Corbasi from Garces, Gravel, and LeBrock on behalf of the plaintiff, Angel Pareja.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Eric Kahn, Jabberbaum, Morgaft, Hicks Kahn, Wickstrom, and Sinnens, amicus on behalf of New Jersey Association for Justice.
Good afternoon. Thank you, counsel, for joining us. I'll be the first to point out that it's somehow fitting we're hearing this case this afternoon. We'll hear first from Mr. Bloom.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd say overwhelmingly fitting, but may it please the court. Your Honors, the issue before us today is whether to impose a duty upon a commercial property owner to remove snow and ice during the course of an ongoing storm. The issue has been addressed in other jurisdictions, the majority of which have held that there is no such duty. But the issue which underpins the various iterations of the ongoing storm rule is not the question of whether it is possible in some instances to keep a sidewalk free of ice in the middle of a winter weather event, but whether it makes sense to impose the cost of trying to do so on the commercial property owner. And the touchstone for the analysis here is Hopkins, and the touchstone in Hopkins is fairness. Hopkins points to four factors to determine whether or not it is fair to impose a duty. In this instance, we speak of number one, the relationship of the parties. Here, we have a pedestrian that has no connection to either defendant or the defendant's property. In short, there is no connection. That is to be compared with every other case that has been cited in these briefs in which the plaintiff was some form of business invitee, was a customer, a patron, a guest, a tenant. Next is the nature of the risk. And undoubtedly, people slip on ice. That happens. That's unassailable. But to my mind, the two most significant factors here are the last two Hopkins factors: the opportunity and ability to exercise care. Said otherwise, the opportunity and ability to remove and/or preclude ice and snow from accumulating when ice and snow is accumulating. There is no competent evidence in this record that one can accomplish such a feat. There is nothing in the record that says if you do X, Y, and Z, ice and snow will not accumulate during an ongoing weather event. Plaintiff's expert cites to ASTM purportedly in support of his position here. But ASTM does not state what plaintiff's expert is using it for. ASTM says nothing about an ongoing storm. ASTM specifically says at paragraph 1.2 that conformance with this guide will not alleviate all snow and hazards, but it speaks to being a reasonable try. ASTM does not say that the de-icing agent that you can use would be intended to preclude ice and snow from forming, but that use of de-icing agent would accelerate and allow or help in the removal later. In short, there's no competent evidence in this record that there is a reliable and expected method to preclude ice and snow from forming during an ongoing weather event. And that brings us to the public policy factor. Does it make sense to impose the cost against this dubious efficacy? What are the costs? Well, the primary cost, I would suggest, is the cost of removal. Trying to remove and or trying to comply. Because undoubtedly, it would require multiple trips, paying someone or doing it yourself for multiple trips to the site to attempt to remove ice and snow as ice and snow is forming. And you can do it 3 times, 4 times, 5 times, but there's no indication that that will reliably prevent the formation of snow and ice. And thus, doing it 3 or 4 or 5 times is not a guarantee against getting sued. And of course, under the appellate division's decision, if you get sued, chances are you're going to a jury trial. Of course, the other obvious cost is the cost of insurance, the cost of the liability. Now, certainly things can be insured, but expectedly it would increase the cost of insurance. And quite honestly, at some point, there may not be insurance for this or that commercial owner, depending upon underwriting practices and so forth. So in short, we would be asking a property owner to engage in, I've been dying to say this, I'm not sure if I'm going to pronounce it correctly, but Sisyphean, because I'm quoting from one of the out-of-court jurisdictions, or out-of-state jurisdictions, to do something with no reasonable expectation of efficacy. And it stands in stark contrast to the repair of a sidewalk, right? When you repair a sidewalk, number one, you're dealing with a non-transient condition. You're dealing with a one-time payment, one-time repair that will reasonably, expectedly be effective. That is very different than expecting a property owner to repeatedly salt, sand, and plow his property in the midst of a winter weather event.
Counsel?
Yes, sir.
My reading of the appellate division opinion leads me to the conclusion that the appellate division is not suggesting that a commercial landowner has to engage in Sisyphean.
That's easy for you to say.
Okay, they specifically say that if it's inexpedient or impractical, then there's no obligation. They're only saying whether or not it's reasonable. And they're saying that there are storms and then there are storms. One like today might be completely impractical and inexpedient. But light precipitation that is going down and icing, why shouldn't a commercial landowner throw down some salt and some sand so its tenants won't be slipping, falling, and breaking their bones as they're trying to enter the building?
Well, there are 3 points that I want to address in Your Honor's comment. And first of all, I'd say you did pause for a moment in my feed. But there are 3 points that I want to address there. First of all, you're telling a property owner that he doesn't have a duty if it's a really bad storm. But unfortunately, under the analysis set forth in the appellate division's decision, that property owner is not going to know whether or not he owes a duty until after a jury tells him whether or not he owes a duty. And by that point, he's already expended the costs of trying to comply with whatever this standard may be, as well as the cost of defending this action. So it's not a no harm, no foul. Let's just wait to see how it shakes out. Ask a jury to say, well, why don't we just, the jury will just do something reasonable. Let's just leave it to the jury to do something reasonable.
Isn't that, wouldn't we be throwing out the entire law of torts if we were no longer considering whether or not the conduct of the would-be tortfeasor was reasonable or unreasonable. I mean, that is like the benchmark of all tort law. And of course, it may not have laser-like precision. There are the weighing of factors, and the appellate division gives a number. One of them, they say, is if it's inexpedient or impractical, no one's expecting anything of you. Only if it's within the possible and you can reduce the risks of your tenants who you're inviting into the building, despite the fact that there's precipitation, should you take some reasonable measure to ensure their safety? Like, what's so wrong about that?
Well, 2 points, Your Honor. Preliminarily, in this particular case, the facts of this case, this person has no connection to this property. This person is a pedestrian who's using the public right of way.
Is that the point of difference that you're making to us? That there would be a duty for a tenant, but not for a pedestrian walking on the same sidewalk in front of the commercial building?
No, it's not. Your Honor, I say that there are four factors that are laid out in Hopkins, right? To my mind, 3 and 4 in this circumstance overwhelmingly lead to a conclusion that it's not fair to impose this duty on the property owner. Number one, in this particular case, even furthers the unfairness. But let me go back to Your Honor's question regarding undoing our jurisprudence. Undoing our jurisprudence would be to say, we're not going to do a duty analysis here.
The purpose of the duty analysis is for a court to determine at the outset if there's a duty. We're not talking about throwing out reasonableness or accepting reasonableness. That's the jury's function once there's found to be a duty. But courts all the time make a determination depending on the circumstances that there is no duty and you never get to reasonableness. And that's all you're looking for here. Am I correct? You're not trying to jettison the reasonableness standard.
Absolutely. No, the duty prong is as foundational as the reasonableness standard is.
And I guess one of your points from what you were saying is you can say the word inexpedient. Oh, well, a storm like this. Well, you may have a situation where someone's hurt in a storm like today, where we're in some places in New Jersey, there might be 18 and 20 inches of snow, where it was possible to plow that snow, and then a jury looking at that later, especially in the face of someone's significant injury, might decide, well, it wasn't expedient, they could have done it. And that's your concern, right? Isn't that correct?
I had it written down in a really beautiful little nugget, but I think the point to be taken here is, you know, oftentimes, not just in court, but in life, we like to cloak things in terms of reasonableness. I'm just going to do what's reasonable. But in this particular context, just asking the jury to do what they feel is reasonable is not reasonable or fair to the property owner.
So let's go back to duty and let's take the tenant issue, because you're saying that's on the table. You're a commercial landowner. You have a building. You don't close the doors to your building. You're inviting everyone on. There's, let's say, light precipitation icing, and it would take fairly little effort to throw down salt to make the pathway safe to the building. Like, why shouldn't there be a duty? You're a profit-making organization. You're profiting off the tenants. Why shouldn't you take reasonable measures under those circumstances to ensure their safety?
Well, Your Honor, if we're talking about such as what we have in this case, we have 12 hours of ongoing freezing.
I'm not talking about.
Doesn't that assume
precipitation?
I'm not talking about whether or not your client should be liable. Forget about. I'm just talking about whether or not, in certain circumstances, it doesn't have to be your case. The landowner, the commercial building owner, owes a duty to the people who it's inviting into its building and profiting from.
But doesn't that assume that the one simple salting would take care of it? Because if I'm going storm and you salt and it ices again and you salt and it ices again, the issue, to me, the issue comes down to how often in between each salting should you do it? And that's the, isn't that the foreseeability of that, that what creates the problem in an ongoing storm, that you don't know how much is coming down? Like today here, it's coming down, I think, less than up north. So you wouldn't need as much, but, and that's the unforeseeability of that seems to me to be the issue.
But I would also add that, you know, it's also the type of precipitation and the circumstances, you know, in this case, we are dealing with hours and hours of light drizzle, albeit, but freezing precipitation, which quite frankly could present a more difficult task than snow that falls at 6 inches deep and our foot is step in it, our foot's fully secure. Again, the point being is that if we open up this obligation during the course of a storm, it creates so many unknowables. And unknowables that are only learned either, you know, at the moment of the fall. In other words, we don't know in this particular case, you know, we know that it was raining, freezing rain at the time of this incident. We know it was various types of freezing precipitation for the previous, I don't believe it's 7 hours or 6 hours. But, you know, we don't know with finite certainty when this ice even formed. And to have, place an obligation upon the landlord then to ensure the safety of his property and his sidewalk again. And by the way, with regard to his sidewalk, he has no control. I shouldn't say that. He cannot control the sidewalk with absolute authority as, say, he could, you know, a part of the private property itself. He can't preclude a pedestrian from coming across his sidewalk. So the reality is that in the course of a 6 or 7 hour, even a light freezing rain, what's reasonable? How often should he go down there? How often should he pay his contractor
In every tort case, doctors have duties to act in a reasonably prudent way. Engineers do, lawyers do. Why shouldn't a commercial tenant have the same obligation to act in a reasonably prudent way? The example given by Justice Fernandez-Vina up here, no duty because there are whiteout conditions. Down there, there may just be a light patina of ice that could be salted. So in one case, it's reasonably prudent to do it and not in the other. Like, why is that so difficult for a commercial landowner? What, same duty is applied to professionals. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, it's the same. You say this, Your Honor says the same duty, but you know, in tort law, we look in various different segments, and there are different duties and different circumstances. This person doesn't owe a duty to this person, or if this person has a duty to this person, it's a recklessness standard, etc. So, Jen, I think it is not appropriate to just say, "Hey, we all have a duty to be reasonable to one another." We're talking about circumstances here where we are talking about the duty of the property owner with ongoing precipitation. And what I would suggest to Your Honor is that when I place that salt down at 6:52 a.m., someone slips on my property at 8 a.m. So should I put it down again at 7:52 a.m.? And I would also, again, go back to what I was saying with regard to the ASTM standard. Again, that standard does not speak to this is how you do it to prevent ice and snow from forming in an ongoing storm.
To what extent should we consider the challenges that a commercial landowner may have in hiring a plowing service or to take care of the situation during an ongoing storm? I mean, I don't have any data on this, but it seems to me that sidewalks are typically cleaned after a storm is over. Maybe that's in part for the safety of the people doing the cleaning, but how do we factor that in, if at all?
Well, if I understand Your Honor's question, are you suggesting that snow removal companies would not be willing to come to the site in the midst of this?
Their practice may be to wait until the storm's over so they could only have to do this once. Prohibitively expensive to get someone to commit to show up every hour or every half hour or whatever it may be during a storm.
Yeah, no, I don't think the snow removal lobby would be upset by a ruling of a duty of ongoing storm removal. I think it would really be hitting the property owner in the pocket. I had a thought and I lost it for a moment, but I'm happy.
Mr. Bloom, the duty that we're talking about would apply across the board to commercial property owners, the big box store, the commercial establishment with plenty of tenants, as well as the local deli, the mom and pop stores on Main Avenue as well?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I missed the very first part of what you just said.
The duty that we're discussing would apply to commercial establishments across the board, from the largest to the smallest. No?
That's correct, yes. I was thinking about that because obviously, Walmart has resources. It's not as cost or not at all, perhaps, I don't know. But I think you get into a dangerous area when you start taking into consideration, a defendant's financials and have that factor in to whether or not to impose a duty. I mean, the reality is that if it's not cost prohibitive, such as, I presume a Walmart, I haven't seen their business filings, but I assume they're doing well. I think with a business such as that, I think the incentive to them is less so a question of liability and more so a question of not discouraging potential shoppers from coming to their store in the midst of a storm.
Why wouldn't a potential shopper be more likely to enter a mom and pop store where the owner of the store has salted the sidewalk that leads to the entrance? Particularly since even a mom and pop store owner has an obligation of taking reasonably prudent steps, even putting aside snow, to ensure that there aren't dangers that might injure a potential customer. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, what was the question there? I know, I understand.
Why would the obligation even be onerous for a mom and pop store owner if there is light icing to throw down salt or sand to protect the customer? Like, why would that be a deterrent to the customer coming into the store? It would seem to me to rather invite more people to go in, knowing that they're—
I wasn't suggesting that salting is a deterrent. I think I said salting would be to not discourage people from coming out and shopping. But what Your Honor's talking about there is a business decision by a business as to whether or not to encourage it. It's different than imposing liability. And again, I come back to the point, Your Honor, I perceive a lot of your questions, it's only a little bit of ice or that sounds like a question in a fixed time frame. But when you're throwing down salt and the ice is still falling and the snow is still falling, yeah, maybe it's a good effort, but is there really a reasonable expectation of efficacy, especially if we're talking about a storm that's occurring over a number of many hours?
Well, just to be clear, the appellate division's decision is not limited by the size of the business, and it's also not limited by the extent of the storm. I mean, the only sort of caveat in the appellate division's decision, tell me if I'm wrong about this, is the impracticable situation. So let's say there's some once in a century storm where there's 3.5 feet of snow and they can't get to their establishment. Maybe that's one where there isn't an obligation, but we're not talking here about light icing and throwing some salt down. a storm like today's storm, which is in which there is a lot of snow accumulating at throughout the state, would be included in the appellate division's decision, unless it got to the point of impracticability. Am I correct?
Yes, that's my understanding. Now, quite frankly, it's not really clear from my reading of the appellate division decision whether, if someone were to fall today, right now, in the midst of this blizzard, whether the court would dismiss that cause of action or whether they would leave it to a jury to determine. I don't know
I don't know why. I don't know why that wouldn't go to a jury under the appellate division's decision. Why do you think it would not go to a jury?
And just as a practical matter, I completely understand and I agree with what Justice Albin said in his dissent for the petition of certification on H.C. Dixon, that the court here has not officially or explicitly ruled on the issue of the ongoing storm rule. But and Your Honor, I believe also reference to perhaps a misapprehension on the part of a number of courts in the appellate level. And of course, that misapprehension trickles down to a number of courts in the trial court level. And I say that to say, what the appellate division decision represents is such a stark swing of the pendulum.
I'm not suggesting we go into whether or not it's a published decision by the appellate division, but my question was, under the appellate division's decision, which is a published decision, wouldn't the storm that is occurring as we speak be included unless it got to the point where it simply became impossible for someone to access the property?
Well, yes, I would say unless the only, I would say if the plaintiff's attorney was able to get an expert to say X, Y, and Z should have been done, and look, we know these de-icing agents work. Short of that, the only other guide we have is that the appellate division's decision says only in rare occasions.
Well, it gives, in all due fairness, it gives eight factors. I'm just going to read the first two. The first one is, would it be inexpedient or impractical? And the second one is the extent of the precipitation, including the amount of snow or ice or accumulation. So there's no way that the appellate division is suggesting that a snowstorm, the likes of which we're experiencing right now, would require a commercial landowner to be sweeping away the snow.
Well, I don't know. That's two of eight factors, so I don't know.
Well, and I want to ask you about that because it says the extent of the storm. That can be read to say the more snow there is, the more the obligation is. I don't respectfully see why you would interpret that to mean the more snow, the less of a duty. It may very well be the appellate division intended to impose a higher duty if there's more snow.
Yes, there are a number of factors in the appellate division decision which clearly are open to interpretation as to how they are to be interpreted and applied. At the end of the day, the appellate division decision leaves us and leaves the more importantly the commercial property owner with an endless amount of confusion and as to what needs to be done to comply. Another point that I think is significant here.
Counsel, would you agree that if the court decides to follow the rule that's being followed by the states that surround New Jersey that have not adopted this rule that the appellate division has now written on, would you agree that there are some factual determinations that would still go to the jury, such as when a storm would reasonably be regarded as concluding, that there would remain factual determinations in the application of this general presumption, if you will, that that there is not a duty to act while a storm is ongoing until a reasonable period of time thereafter. Does it seem in those cases they acknowledge a good number of cases still going to the jury when those questionable factual situations arrive?
Yes, and the case that comes to mind for me is Henderson versus Reed, which I believe came out of Indiana, where there was an issue of fact. The plaintiff said it was sunny and clear at the time of his fall. The defendants were relying upon weather records, which indicated that the storm was ongoing, and that was left for a jury to decide that issue. Oh, if I may, one other point that I'd like to add is that by imposing the duty that, of course, we are hoping the court imposes or does not compose. Maybe I should just stop talking at this point. I think I've run out of words. I'm happy that I touched upon what I want to touch upon, and I'll take any other questions or comments that anyone wishes to direct at me.
Other questions, anyone? Thank you, Mr. Bloom. Mr. Sirocco.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. The storm rule is a common sense application of basic tort principles to the reality and uncertainty of winter weather. Requiring commercial landowners to clear snow and ice while it is accumulating would impose an extraordinary burden of care that is inconsistent with the abiding sense of basic fairness espoused by this court in Hopkins. It would also leave the fact finder without a workable or intelligible standard in attempting to determine whether or not the commercial landowner's conduct was reasonable. Accordingly, the appellate division should be reversed. I'd like to spend some of my time, at least today, addressing some of the exceptions to the ongoing storm rule, which I think gets at your question, Justice LaVecchia, and when there would be fact questions that would still be submitted to a fact finder, which I think would be, even during ongoing storms, in a not insignificant number of cases. I'd also like to try to address Justice Albin's concerns about some of the limits of the ongoing storm rule and why it, in fact, would be not reasonable to impose upon a commercial landowner an obligation to clear snow or ice during an ongoing storm. The ongoing storm rule is important, and the exceptions are important into attempting to determine when the rule applies and when it does not apply. And I would note that the exceptions to the rule, even though they're discussed in many of the cases that adopt the ongoing storm rule, are not touched upon in any way by the appellate division in its published opinion. The first important point is that the ongoing storm rule is just that. It's a rule that applies during ongoing storms and only during ongoing storms. It's not the ongoing rain rule. It's not the ongoing mist rule. It's specifically limited in its scope and its application to a certain type of weather event. That is, precipitation that is actively resulting in the accumulation of ice and snow. And it's for this reason that every case that adopts the rule says, if we take that as our framework, if that is what an ongoing storm is, then by its very nature, it is going to be ineffective and impractical for a commercial landowner to engage in the Sisyphean task of attempting to remove the snow while it is accumulating. I think what the appellate division attempted to do was to take many of these factors and put them into the 8 factors that Justice Albin was referring to as to what a commercial landowner, what a jury should look to in deciding whether or not a commercial landowner was reasonable. But the problem is these factors are oftentimes contradictory and they're not leading to an intelligible standard, which is important under Hopkins. Hopkins says that. If we take Hopkins as our framework, the issue there was the duty of a real estate broker. The court didn't just say the real estate broker has to do whatever is reasonable. The court made distinctions. It has to take only those reasonable actions that are in accordance with what a real estate broker would normally do. It contrasted it to the duties of a landowner. So it really specifically defined the scope of the duty in that case. If we look at the eight factors that were addressed by the appellate division, some of them just point in completely opposite directions, such as whether or not the snowfall, I think this is the third and the fourth factor. Did the snowfall happen at night or during the daytime? Were there a lot of people using the property or only a few people using the property? I mean, what's the implication there? If it falls during the daytime when the landowner can see it, but more people are using the property, that the obligation of the commercial landowner is higher? Or is it higher at nighttime when fewer people are using the property, but the hazard is more difficult to see? I think jurors would be lost when answering this question because there are no good answers to these questions. How many times during the storm, if snow or ice is accumulating, does a commercial landowner have to go out during the storm and throw salt down or calcium chloride or sand or shovel? Is it once an hour? Is it once every 2 hours?
Counsel, just because someone has to make judgments doesn't mean that there isn't a duty. Take Hopkins. So Hopkins is a real estate broker who has an obligation of telling a person who's brought onto the premises of dangers, of which the broker knows or should know. Now, what is a danger? And that will always be subject to interpretation. I'm sure that's subject to litigation. Did the broker act reasonably? It's not as stark as you seem. It requires judgment in every circumstance. And I don't know, and one can argue this is the same. There'll be some circumstances in which you can expediently and practically act, and there are others that you cannot. So I don't see why Hopkins necessarily forecloses this, given that even in Hopkins, a judgment has to be made by real estate brokers. So why don't you address that?
A couple of points in response to that, Justice Halpin. I agree with Your Honor that the first factor in your colloquy with Mr. Bloom, the relationship of the parties came up. The first factor in our mind is not dispositive. It's the second and the third factors that make the difference here and that make the imposition of a duty different than the duty that this court imposed in Hopkins, the nature of the hazard and the opportunity to exercise care. Because in the midst of all the judgment calls, there are still going to be hard questions. In ongoing storm cases, there are hard questions and difficult distinctions to make. And perhaps I'll be able to talk about those in some of the exceptions to the rule. But the problem that we have is you're throwing in a weather event that is by its very nature uncontrollable or unforeseeable. We don't often know when weather events are going to start. We don't know the type of hazards they're going to bring. For all the answers that modern technology has brought, we don't oftentimes know when they're going to end. And so the effectiveness—
Isn't it also true, Counselor, with a weather event, the severity of it varies and goes back and forth. It's not as static dangerous as some of the dangers that we're talking about in Hopkins.
That's right, Justice Fernandez-Vina, but that I think gets us nicely into some of the exceptions to the rule and the scope of the rule. The cases I would point your honors to on that question are the Grease case from the Supreme Court of Iowa just last summer and the Krause case from the Supreme Court of Connecticut, addressing when you had intersecting storms. Is the weather fairly continuous or is it stopping or is it starting again? If the ice forms at 1 a.m. and the fall doesn't occur until 7 a.m., there are real questions about did the hazard form prior to the storm actually starting? That's an important exception to the rule, but it goes, Justice Albin, back to this question of control. What is the harm that the landowner is imposing is contributing to the incident, as opposed to what's being caused by something outside of the landowner's control, which an ongoing storm is by its very definition and by its very nature. The pre-existing condition, the hazard that develops prior to the storm starting, that is something that the landowner can control. And the classic case of this is addressed by the Supreme Court of Virginia in the Walker case. If ice exists prior to the storm starting and snow simply comes and covers up that ice condition, that is a question that the fact finder can determine. Well, that harm wasn't caused by the ongoing storm. That was caused by something that the landowner negligently and unreasonably allowed to persist on his property despite being able to remediate it. But if I can come back to Justice Albin's question about why can't the jury make this judgment call? I mean, that's the ultimate the ultimate case that the appellate division and my friends on the other side set forth. They say, well, sure, effectiveness and practicality, we're not discounting any of that, but isn't that better resolved by jurors instead of judges? And the answer to that is no, for an important reason. And it's a reason that all courts, including the appellate division below, except the appellate division actually says this three times in its opinion. A landowner is not an absolute insurer of safety. It's not a de facto insurer. It doesn't have to take every conceivable remedy that it might be able to do to attempt to make the property safer. The problem with the appellate division's analysis is that is exactly the effect that rejecting the ongoing storm rule in the way that it did will have. Landowners will be faced with a choice during ongoing storms, during any accumulation of snow or ice. They'll have to decide, do I take extraordinary efforts to keep my property safe and make sure that nobody falls, or do I allow snow and ice to accumulate, run the risk that a pedestrian is going to become severely injured in the storm, bring a lawsuit, retain a well-credentialed expert to get up and testify and persuade a jury that, you know, going out once an hour or once every 2 hours or only salting once at the beginning of the storm, that really wasn't reasonable. Here's, ladies and gentlemen, what the landowner should have done in that situation. I mean, pick your number. The point with all those different variations of what an expert could say is that there's no good answer to the question. When you're dealing with an ongoing storm, what a commercial landowner has to do. Now, to come back to the exceptions, there are other issues after the storm. How long does a commercial landowner have to go out after the storm ends? That's a fact question to be addressed by the jury. But again, that's within the commercial property owner's control. Did the commercial property owner increase the danger or aggravate or exacerbate the danger? The best case on this, Your Honors, is the Terry case from the Supreme Court of Rhode Island, which involved a plaintiff who had brought her car in to be serviced at an auto body shop at 10 a.m., goes back at 4 p.m. in the afternoon. Her car is nowhere to be found. There's an active snow or ice condition. And the attendant at the auto body shop says, ma'am, your car's in the back. It's about 100 feet away. You've got to walk out there. By the way, be careful. It's snowing and icing there. The court said, no, that's not enough. If you're going to do that, if you're going to aggravate or exacerbate the condition in that way, then the fact finder can determine, notwithstanding the ongoing storm rule, whether or not you acted reasonably. In cases like this one, I think, as we set forth in our brief, we're not taking a position on whether or not summary judgment is appropriate here. I think I would rely on the parties for that, and the trial court, I think, are the best determiners of that factor. But in this case, Mr. Bloom just admitted, we don't know when the ice formed in this case. There's evidence here that the weather was intermittent, that it had stopped at a certain point in time. There might have been trace amounts of precipitation falling that weren't resulting in an active accumulation of snow or ice. In that situation, what happens is the fact finder gets instructed on the doctrine. They would be told, if you find that the fall occurred during an ongoing storm as a result of an accumulation that was ongoing during that storm, you must find for the commercial landowner. If you find that the hazard preexisted the storm, that the commercial landowner increased the danger, or some other question of fact, that there wasn't a storm ongoing at the time, then they, with the doctrine in mind, they get to resolve that fact. Those are hard.
Mr. Sirocco, I'm just mindful of the time. Are there other points you wanted to raise?
No, Your Honor, unless the court has, the last thing I would say is this. One point that I think is somewhat problematic, and this has been touched upon by some of the other justices' questions, is that the appellate division's ruling strips courts of their gatekeeping function, which is a problem under Brill. Whether or not a case is meritorious or not and can command the judicial resources, this is a question that's, of course, on every lawyer and judge's mind in normal times, and particularly so now when we have such a large backlog of cases in light of the pandemic waiting to get to trial. I think judges need to be able to make the real determination as to whether or not a case is meritorious in light of the doctrine. And before we impose upon landlords the modern day Sisyphean task of trying to decide whether and when it's appropriate to remove snow and ice during an ongoing storm, we should try to be mindful that the ongoing storm rule does seek a balance between the interests of the pedestrian and the commercial landowners. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. Corvasi.
Hey, please, the court. Good afternoon. I just want to start off by addressing some of the questions raised by Justin Albin to Mr. Bloom regarding the describing of the parties as far as whether he was going to that property or just walking by. Our Supreme Court has stated in Stewart that commercial properties are essentially, let me find it. The Stewart court took all of that into consideration. The court reasoned the economic benefits to a business owner justified the recognition of a maintenance duties. Sidewalks provide commercial owners with easy access to the premise and increase the value of their property. Public use of commercial establishments is facilitated by the existence of sidewalks. So I think it makes no difference whether or not Mr. Perea was going to that building or somewhere else. The ease of access of a pedestrian should not be impeded. Turning to the appellate decision in Perea, I believe it was a well-reasoned decision that firmly traces the development of our precedent establishing the imposition of a duty on the commercial property owner to maintain a public sidewalk. The appellate court comprehensively discussed the decisional law in other states that both follow and reject the ongoing storm doctrine, outlining the theories offered in support of and against. Respondent makes no attempt here to recapitulate the well-reasoned and comprehensive opinion of the appellate division. I would like to briefly state some of the facts. 7:50 a.m., January 12, 2015, my client Angel Perea, age 41, parked his car across from defendant's property. He walked towards the property wearing slip-resistant shoes, the type of shoes usually worn by those in the restaurant service industry. He made visual observations of the ground.
Mr. Corvasi?
Yes, sir.
Forgive me for interrupting. We're familiar with the factual record in this case. We're okay. Here primarily for the legal issue of whether a duty should be imposed. Would you like to address that, or are you done with your opening statement? Are you open to questions at this point?
I am open to questions. Go ahead. Sure. Questions.
So imagine at the end of this argument, somebody who has watched calls you up and says, counsel, I would like your guidance as to what to do during the course of the storm. How do I protect myself against liability? What advice do you provide?
Allow me to answer it like this. My fiance does property management. She's not a lawyer, just a layperson, but she does property management. I told her about this case and the ramifications of it, and she said, I don't get it. We already pre-treat all of our properties way in advance. We know about this. What happens if the Supreme Court change in any way? I said, well, okay. I said, well, in my case, the property owner did not throw any salt or sand. She goes, oh, well, it's his fault then. You shouldn't have done that. So
with all due respect for your fiance, we have no idea what kind of resources her employer has that we're talking about. If I can add to the chief's question, let's say it's a small business where the proprietor would have to do the work himself or herself on a day like today. What's your advice?
Simply grab a $7 bag of salt, go out there and throw some. It's not.
I haven't looked out the window recently, but it seems like any bag of salt that was thrown down at this minute is going to be disappear in 20 minutes. So is that all it takes? Just a bag of salt and then the snow keeps coming and you're done?
No, obviously that depends on the size of the storm. If it's a month, again, the jury's going to hear all that. It's a reasonableness decision for the jury. If it's a heavy, heavy storm with tons of snow, we've seen this in the unpublished decision Hill versus St. Barnabas, where the woman fell in a huge snowstorm and the hospital was actually in the process of trying to take care of the snowstorm. She slipped and fell, and the jury and appellate division said, sorry, but they were acting reasonably.
So by your answer that the jury's going to hear this and sort it out, it sounds like you don't disagree from your friends who preceded you, who say all these cases will end up in front of a jury, we'll have no summary judgments. Is that right?
Well, I don't think that's such a bad thing.
Well, one of the justifications for this rule that is a theme in many of the out-of-state decisions where courts have adopted it, but it was not mentioned in any detail in the decision below, is that it's designed to allow landowners to know what to do under changing circumstances. And that was key, changing circumstances of an ongoing storm. Because if one has to constantly react to different stimuli in terms of weather, which is not within the control of the landlord, then it undermines uniformity of approach, predictability. And as I understand the case law in some of these other states, that was a large reason that motivated adoption of the rule in the first place. So when you say go to the jury, doesn't that eliminate a key purpose to the rule that advances a legitimate social purpose?
I'm sorry, I just don't understand the question.
Do you agree that the ongoing storm rule was designed to allow property owners a mechanism for dealing with the changing circumstances of an unpredictability of ongoing weather?
I don't think that the ongoing storm rule has ever been adopted by our state. I think it came out of a 1926 Court of Common Pleas and Appeals and Errors decision.
Errors and Appeals Council.
Beg your pardon?
It's an Errors and
Appeals. Other states.
Errors and Appeals. The ongoing storm rule has become anachronistic and harsh on those that are injured. And I think it should never have gotten to this stage. I mean, 95 years.
But counsel, the purpose that I'm describing was just used by the Supreme Court of Iowa in the Alcala decision and then reaffirmed in Greece in 2020. I mean, these are recent cases that are still pointing to legitimate social policy that's advanced by continuing the rule. Why is it anachronistic?
Why is it? I think the fundamental goal of tort law is to compensate those that have been injured who were innocent and to spread the burden of those best positioned to make the area safe.
Do you agree this is not a strict liability case, that these kinds of falls and injuries don't automatically, in other words, it's not up to the landowner to disprove negligence, it's up to the plaintiff to prove negligence. Do you agree with that at least?
Absolutely, yes. It's the job of the plaintiff to prove negligence. And there is, as the Perea decision laid out, there's several material facts that a jury would hear in this.
Well, I only pointed that out because it sounded like you were talking about strict liability. Do you also agree that whether a storm is ongoing is an important factor in determining any outcome, even the outcome that you want, that whether it's ongoing and the nature of that storm and the changing circumstances, as Justice LaVecchia has described, are important factors? You argue it's not controlling, but they certainly are important, are they not?
Yes, of course. They are factors that a jury would hear and decide.
You're just saying...
Could any commercial landlord obtain summary judgment if there's an ongoing storm?
Yes. If plaintiff is unable to prove any facts where the commercial landowner would have had actual or constructive notice and they did nothing, such as in our case.
Actual or constructive notice of a storm?
Yeah.
Don't you just have to look out the window?
No, they can look to the weather reports, such as...
If you're in your store, you look out the window, you see if there's a storm or not, don't you?
Right, correct.
How can you have actual or constructive notice?
By watching the Weather Channel, as was the situation in this case. The person, the vice president of the company, the only vice president, testified that he watched the Weather Channel every single day.
Did that? Okay.
And he did nothing. A supervisor of the company noted that earlier on the morning of this incident, he was driving his kids to school.
We're familiar with that, counsel. Let me just add to Justice Fernandez-Vina's question then. Assuming that the defendant either looked out the window, as in today, and saw a storm, or watched the Weather Channel, or checked it online, is aware of the storm. That's the only thing. If that happens, and an individual's injured during an ongoing storm, can the landowner ever get summary judgment?
No.
Why not? You just, if it's inexpedient, factor number one, in the appellate division opinion, it's inexpedient, impractical. It's coming down hard every hour on the hour. And therefore, the effort to clear the sidewalk is going to be futile. Like, why wouldn't a judge under those circumstances be able to grant summary judgment?
I suppose Mr. Khan may be in the better position to respond to that question.
Mr. Crivasi, why don't you tell us why you think it is both appropriate and wise for a duty to be imposed in cases like this? Give us your theory.
My theory is that the appellate division's Perea decision is just a continuation in the trend that we've already been moving towards, as seen in Stewart and Mirza, and that we have this ongoing storm rule, which has never been officially adopted by the New Jersey Supreme Court or any published appellate division court. And it's resulting in the harsh consequences of what my client has. My client's 41 years old, has a broken hip, and his case got essentially tossed out because of the ongoing storm rule. Something that is just unfair.
Thank you. Are there other questions members of the court have? Anything you'd like to add, Mr. Crivasi?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Khan.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court. You know, one of the advantages or maybe disadvantages of going last is you're not always sure where to start. So here's where I'm going to start. I heard a number of comments, both on the defense side and some of Your Honor's questioning about the jury and what are they going to do? And are they going to be confused? And what are they going to judge this by? So, you know, I try cases. So as someone who tries cases, these questions are decided by our jurors every day. We like to give our jurors a little bit more credit for being able to determine what's reasonable or not. They're asked in every tort case that they hear to judge the reasonableness of the defendant's conduct.
Mr. Khan, they're not asked to determine duty. They're just not. Respectfully, they're asked to, of course, when there is a duty and a potential breach of duty, and there's enough to go to the jury, they are always asked to deal with reasonableness. But duty is always a determination for the court. Am I correct about that?
You're correct about that. The justice, it might have been Justice Fernandez-Vina who asked about, is there ever a situation where summary judgment could be granted? Of course there can. And Justice Patterson, I was going to get back to this because...
What would that be the situation under the facts that counsel for the respondent here presents? And under what situation can I envision summary judgment being granted under the rule that your counsel presents?
Justice, we have a storm. I'm up in North Jersey now. I understand that the conditions in South Jersey are much different. I have about 18 inches outside on my property. You know, you can have such a massive storm.
Let me stop you. Have you been outside to put ice yet? Or have you been sitting inside?
I'm inside, thankfully.
Did you go outside, put some ice on in case somebody falls?
I'm not thinking, well, you know what? In my development, they started salting last night. They've been plowing. It woke me up maybe three times in the middle of the night. They've been plowing all night, every couple hours. Now, for the last several hours, because the storm got worse, when I woke up this morning, it was not as big a deal as it is now. They've stopped plowing. They've stopped salting. In this circumstance, since we talked a lot about the storm today, they tried. Unlike the defendant said, they don't have to keep coming out ice.
But Mr. Kahn, where do you get that in the appellate division's decision? Because you know, in exchange with Justice Albin, there was a suggestion that more snow means less of a burden. But I don't read that factor as saying more snow. I thought I interpreted maybe wrongly that the more snow there is, the more ice there is, the higher the more likely the duty is going to be imposed. So where do we find solace in the appellate division?
First of all, I didn't suggest more snow, less, more of a duty.
No, I know you didn't. I'm suggesting my question to Mr. Kahn that I read it to be that the appellate division to be that way. Tell us, where is the limiting principle in the appellate division's decision that would possibly mean it's reasonable to stop plowing when it gets to 12 inches of snow or 14 or 18? I don't see it.
Yeah, I think I made a note when Your Honor asked this question before the defense. I think you may be overreading it, because I found during the course of the argument before, exactly in the appellate division decision, where they talk about this. Now, they don't talk about it factually, because I want to go back to that later. All storms are different. But what they say is, we are not imposing strict liability or any mandate that a commercial landowner owner must always, under every circumstance, shoulder the expense of plowing and replowing a parking lot during a continuous storm. That would be entirely unreasonable to do so. And in the next
right. Am I correct that it defaults to the jury, because it's a question of reasonableness? According to the appellate division, it goes to the jury as to whether it's reasonable. So where is the limiting principle under a duty analysis for the court that would possibly suggest that the people in your obviously very well run development don't have to plow all night?
Justice, it's found in the four prongs of the Hopkins case, which was set forth in the appellate division decision. You know, there's the four factors, and I didn't even get to that yet, but I disagree with some of what the defense has argued. But the trial judge has to go through the four Hopkins factors. And this is in any, you know, premise, you know, snow and ice case, fall down case, premise liability case. And what you find repeatedly, whether it's in Hopkins, what I didn't get to say before when I was talking about jurors, you know, we find it right in all of our model jury charges. Everyone that deals with
that. Mr. Kahn, can I follow up? And the focus is particularly with respect to factor three, opportunity and ability to exercise care. And this goes to the very basic workability of the rule. I asked Mr. Corvassi, and perhaps you can help, what would you advise a client calling you moments after this argument? They want to be free from liability. What should they do?
My advice is going to be dependent upon a couple of factors. Is it Walmart or is it a mom and pop shop owner? Is it an 18-inch storm or is it sleet that may have frozen? Because one of the factors when you're considering the reasonableness of actions taken by the commercial landowner is, you know, what are they? What's their size? What are their resources? To assume, as the defense is asking Your Honors to assume, that there's gonna be tremendous costs to commercial landowners every time there's a storm of any nature, irrespective of how large or small it is, it's just not true. So
there some additional challenges? I mean, meteorology is one of those rare fields where we expect to pay experts even when they get it wrong. And, you know, hindsight is always 20/20, but that's seldom the case in the middle of the storm. How often? Your client wants to know, do I have to go out every hour, every two, every three? What should I do, counsel?
Justice, you're asking
what me, does one say?
You're asking me a question in a vacuum without, you know, look, again, it depends upon the size, this type of storm, the size of the storm, the length of the storm.
Today, right on Main Street in your town.
You have to do, first of all, what you can't do is nothing. You can't do nothing. To allow a commercial landowner with a bright line rule to do nothing, to abdicate every subjective responsibility they have to do something is one of the biggest problems with this bright line rule. So you can't advise them to do nothing and just see what happens and hope nobody falls. You have to do something. You have to, it depends again, the size of the property, maybe a salt, maybe a shovel the walkway. If you have a large parking lot, you hire a snowplow. And guess what? If the snowplowers can come once or twice or three times, and then the storm gets so bad where they call the owner and say, look, we just can't come anymore. It's dangerous for our people. It's not working. It's going to snow for too long. Hey, that's a factor. They can get a certification, you know, to use that to support their motion to have a case dismissed. It all comes to doing something reasonably.
Does the difficulty of fashioning a rule, and I appreciate your good faith effort at working through this question with us, does that factor into the appropriateness of imposition of a duty here? This is unlike a visible hazard in the backyard where you've invited someone.
Yeah, imposition of a duty, I think in every, you know, all of our fall down cases, broken sidewalks, snow and ice, we know under our law, starting with Stewart, there is a duty that commercial landowners have to do something. The next step is then what is reasonable? They have the duty they have is to act reasonably under the circumstances, whether it's a storm, rain, you know, a broken sidewalk. So we know there's a duty on the part of commercial landowners, unlike residential property owners, to do something. Okay. The question then is not do they have a duty here. The question is whether or not they've done something reasonably to either help or eliminate the condition that may cause an accident. So I think that whether there's a duty or not is not the right.
You're willing to concede, and you've given the very example of your own neighborhood. If it's inexpedient or impractical to clear the sidewalk or clear the roadway, there is not going to be a duty. And in that circumstance, a judge would be within his or her authority to grant summary judgment, no?
Absolutely.
Could you imagine many plaintiffs conceding that point about inexpediency and the impracticality?
Justice, it's not a matter of whether or not a plaintiff may concede that point. The question is, again, I used the example before, if the defendant landowner has, you know, can easily get testimony from their whoever they hired to get rid of snow and ice that we just couldn't do it under the circumstances, and then as a question for the judge initially.
Wouldn't a very fine plaintiff's lawyer retort very quickly saying that snowplow companies just, you can get names of a dozen instantaneously. They're all looking for work. So your guy didn't want to show up anymore. Well, get on the phone and get the next guy. I mean, what is an expediency to you in this circumstance?
Just Patterson before, and I'm going to answer that. But, you know, as a plaintiff's lawyer, since you raised, there are, you know, I have someone fall in the middle of this 20-inch storm. I mean, I'm not looking, you know, just to go get by summary judgment to go spend a lot of money on a tried case where I know a jury is going to think I'm being unreasonable. I mean, that just, you know, we make decisions when we evaluate cases and what's going on.
Understood, but we're talking about a rule that applies statewide and all kinds of different circumstances and many different lawyers involved. But the rule can
apply statewide even in this storm. The rule can be applied differently because, again, as I understand it, in South Jersey, it's raining. It's changed terrain. There may be a duty down there to more quickly, you know, try to correct the problem than we have up here where I'm looking at 18, 20 inches of snow.
But let me go back to my question. I'm sorry. I said too many words there. What is inexpediency as used in the appellate division's decision?
Well,
I'll tell you how I interpret it. It means it really can't be done. Whatever it is, it's got to be to the level of it really can't be done before you get any relief under this rule.
Sure, it's the example that I've given now, I think once or twice. If it just the weather conditions are so bad and so poor that no reasonable person can be expected to go out and try to plow or salt or sand or shovel, you know, there's certainly going to be examples of that, which will allow cases to be dismissed. There's no doubt about it.
Who would make the decision and say where it's so bad or so poor?
Let's start with the judge.
The judge won't make that decision. Now to go to a jury. Jury will decide it.
Again,
no judge. I've tried cases too, counsel. There's no judge around, and I did defense work, as I'm sure you know. There's no judge that's going to grant me summary judgment on so bad or so poor. It's going to go to a jury.
But it's got nothing. See, but that it's got nothing to do with, in my opinion, with the ongoing storm rule that we're arguing. It still goes back to reasonableness. I mean, You know, the ongoing storm rule, the bright line that the defense is asking is so, it just encourages landlords to do nothing. It encourages unreasonable conduct.
So that's the question I wanted to ask you. And that's a policy decision that the defense has to address or grapple with. If we adopt the ongoing storm rule, are we going to encourage commercial landowners to do nothing? Because if they do something, then if they don't do it exactly right or correctly, then they're going to be subject to suit. And therefore, everyone's going to be standing by watching their patrons slip and slide and fall.
Justice Albin, that's 100% that's what's going to happen. And also, you're going to encourage commercial landowners to extend out to as long as they possibly can. When did the storm actually end? Is it when the last flurry fell? Is it when the last drop of rain fell? And then also,
is what, presuming that people believe at least, and that's the way the cases seem to go, that we're abiding by an ongoing storm rule or concept. Is that what is happening now? There are these countless cases of people slipping and sliding and getting hurt with landlords doing nothing. I mean, I don't think they're doing nothing in this neighborhood.
That's the fallacy of this whole argument, though, because that's the point. We don't have an ongoing storm rule. What landlords are doing now is what they believe.
No, that's not what I asked. Is that what they're doing? I mean, the perception seems to be, and certainly among the cases reported and unreported that we get, that there is this concept that while the storm is ongoing, there is not that same duty. Are we seeing cases being dismissed, summary judgment, where landlords are doing nothing and people are falling and slipping and sliding? Or are we seeing summary judgment? Are we seeing summary judgment on different bases? They're actually doing stuff, but they're not doing enough.
We see it both ways now, Your Honor. We see it both ways because there's some confusion as to the applicability of the ongoing storm rule. I'm telling you, we've had cases dismissed before this appellate division decision. Some trial judges have changed their opinion because of this appellate division decision. The answer is yes, they are being dismissed. That's why we need to.
No, but that wasn't the question, counsel. The question was, do you see a pattern? Because you seem to say that the perception in New Jersey is that we have an ongoing storm rule. You don't have to do anything. What he's asking you is, do you see a pattern where landlords are saying, we don't have to do anything because the ongoing storm rule, and your people are falling and being hurt because nothing's going on? Is that a pattern?
Sure, some do, absolutely. I can't say it's a pattern among big versus small. It's certainly a pattern among certain defendants, absolutely. Certain commercial landlords, absolutely. They figure
that it's identified to that particular landlord, not to this perception that they don't have to, the landlords in the state have to do nothing.
I think so. I don't have any data to support that, but I believe so. I think some of them take the position that I don't have to do a thing and nothing, you know, and whatever, and nothing can happen to me, 100%. So to encourage, to adopt this rule, to encourage this rule, all that is going to do is encourage more of that. All it's going to do is, I mean, every commercial landowner, big, small, irrespective of the type of storm, how many inches we get, whether it goes to sleet, whether it goes to rain, everyone's going to say, you know what, until that last drop falls, and for a reasonable amount of time after that last drop falls, I don't have to do a thing. That's what the ongoing storm rule tells me.
Other questions, anyone?
I'm sorry.
Mr. Khan, please go ahead. I was going to invite you to add whatever you'd like.
It violates every, basic premise of New Jersey's law regarding obligations of a commercial landowners, going back to Stewart. It violates every tenet of all the model jury charges, which I've written down, which talk about negligence in different circumstances. It gives commercial landowners carte blanche to do nothing, because it's only to their detriment if they do so. And that doesn't benefit our public. It doesn't benefit people who are walking on our sidewalks and our parking lots. And it's long been determined, I think goes back to Stewart, that, and this goes to one of the four Hopkins factors, that our courts have consistently found that commercial landowners are in a much better position than members of the public to clear their sidewalk. There's no data that I've seen here that shows how much more it's going to cost to do the eliminate the snow and ice. I've seen no data before this court as to how much insurance rates are going to increase. And even if they do increase by pennies, what's better? It's better to protect the public. That's what our courts have said consistently, again, going back a number of years.
Do you have a sense of what's happened in the states that have adopted this rule?
I do not.
The issue we've been discussing?
I do not. I noticed, you know, and the fact that some states around us adopt the rule versus other states is irrelevant. There's some states that are for it, some states that are against it. I don't know what's happened. To me, it's irrelevant. New Jersey, our Supreme Court's always been on the forefront, especially when it comes to tort law, of making law. So I have to tell you, it really is irrelevant to me as to what other states, I don't care if we're in the minority, I'm not sure that we are, but whether we're in the minority or not, that's a position that we've been very, New Jersey's been very comfortable with over the years. And if we're in the minority on this issue, so be it.
I asked the question going back to what Justice Solomon and Justice Fernandez Vina were asking, whether this would lead to the concerns that you've articulated. But we don't have a sense whether that's the case in other states.
I don't know how we would know that, and I don't know that, no.
Anything you'd like to add to your presentation?
No, thank you.
Thank you. And thank counsel, and I wanted to thank Mr. Khan and